Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am delighted to welcome Dr. Holly Ordway to the show to speak about J.R.R. Tolkien. Holly is the Cardinal Francis George Professor of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute, as well as the Visiting Professor of Apologetics at Houston Christian University. She's written numerous books and articles about various members of the Inklings, but our focus today is Holly's newest book, which I've got right next to me, an absolutely fantastic spiritual biography of J.R.R. Tolkien called Tolkien's Faith, and I highly, highly recommend you get a copy of it. The Lord of the Rings trilogy continues to top surveys listing people's favourite books of all times. They've been translated into more than 50 languages, and they've only grown in popularity since the release of the Hollywood film adaptations in the early 2000s. As we've already seen through some of the things that we've talked about in previous episodes, many people who read and enjoy the stories are not necessarily aware of Tolkien's faith, but it certainly was not just important, but completely integral to Tolkien. And while he rejected the notion, as you've already said, Holly, that The Lord of the Rings was a religious allegory, he does, however, describe it in a letter as a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. I mean, this is huge, but what does he mean by that, that it's a fundamentally religious and Catholic work?
That's such a great question, because that quote is probably one of the most famous ones about The Lord of the Rings. And we really have to unpack this, I think, because he says it's fundamentally religious and Catholic in that letter. But then in other places, he says, for instance, that it is about, it's not about anything but itself. Or in another place, he says it has no inner meaning or message. So we have to say, wait, what's going on here? We can't just sort of uncritically say he said it was fundamentally religious, therefore it's all about the gospel. No, it's more complicated than that. So I think he's very clear in, when you look at the places where he pushes back, he's very clear that he's not explicitly presenting a religious message. That's the one thing he's definitely not doing. He didn't set out to say, I'm going to write something that's Christian. And if you look at the larger context of that quote we started with, you know, he says, and I am quoting from memory, but this is a quote I've said enough times, I think I've got it right. So it's a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously in the writing, but consciously in the revision. And right there, we have a really important key to what he's doing. Unconsciously, it was fundamentally religious and Catholic. Why? Because he was fundamentally religious and Catholic. So his values, his worldview, his ethos, it's naturally expressed in the very fabric of the story, because that's who he is. And then he says consciously in the revision. So then he does do certain things to highlight what he's doing. But then he also goes on in that letter to say that he has deliberately taken out the overt references to religion. So again, he's being very deliberate that insofar as it is religious, it is at the fundaments, at the foundations. It's implicit, it's not explicit. Because The Lord of the Rings, his vision of it is as a prehistory of our world. That's his conceit, that it all happened in the long past. So in that sense, it cannot be overtly Christian at the level of the story because these events haven't happened yet. And that's very different from, say, the Chronicles of Narnia that are in some way, you know, it's a different relationship between Christianity and the imagined world, different way of approaching it. In Middle Earth, it can't be overtly Christian by the nature of the story. And I think he wanted to make sure that it was all implicit. So when we've touched on a few of these things, you know, already in some of our previous conversations, but the ways in which then it is fundamentally religious and Catholic, things like themes, the way he says that one of the themes of the Lord of the Rings is death and the desire for deathlessness. Well, the death, the meaning of death, and what is deathlessness as opposed to immortality? These are things that are fundamentally connected to his Catholic understanding of reality. Or you have, you know, obviously themes of good and evil, but even the idea of humility. We've talked in another episode about how important the virtue of humility was to Tolkien, and he connects that to, explicitly connects it to the Magnificat, Mary's song of praise. You know, she's the humble handmaid of the Lord, and he connects that also then to his hobbits. And connects his hobbits to that virtue of humility. And he says that the Lord of the Rings is about the ennoblement or the sanctification of the humble. So here we have a theological element woven into Middle Earth. It's actually the hobbits. The hobbits in their simplicity, their humility, their littleness, the fact that they are the agents by which Middle Earth is saved, and not the powerful warrior Aragorn, not the powerful wizard Gandalf, not the wise Elrond. The humble, weak, childlike hobbits are the ones by whom Middle Earth is saved. That's a fundamentally Catholic theme, comes out of his own spirituality. So these are not things you would necessarily expect, but that's where we see these Catholic elements unfolding. Primarily.
And obviously we've touched on the importance of various aspects of his Catholic faith, but why was the Eucharist so important to Tolkien? And how do we see his love for what he called the Blessed Sacrament? Do we see that anywhere in The Lord of the Rings?
Well, I think the Eucharist was really central to his spirituality, because as a Catholic, he believed that in the Eucharist, Christ is really present. Body, blood, soul, and divinity. This is not just a symbol. This is not a memorial. This is actually Christ under the accidents of the bread and the wine. And so that is his encounter with the risen Lord, his actual personal encounter with Christ, not just in prayer, which obviously he did, but in the sacrament of the Eucharist. And that was really important for Tolkien and for his spirituality throughout his whole life. And so that means that, you know, for Tolkien to have his spirituality focused on the Eucharist means that his spirituality is focused on Christ. So it's a Christocentric spirituality because of that. That's what it means to be centered on the Eucharist. So I think, you know, and that connects into something we've talked about before, about the importance of the word, about the importance of incarnation. All of these things sort of tie in the idea of God, you know, communicating his grace through the things of the material world. Because when the Catholic receives the host, the consecrated host, it still tastes like bread, because that's the material that, you know, has been transubstantiated into the body and blood of Christ. But it's still using the material things as, you know, as the matter of the sacrament. And that connection between the spiritual and material, I think, is really important for Tolkien. It's not separated into different categories, you know, tidy little categories of the material and the spiritual. Yeah. So I think that whole idea of this interconnection, you know, undergirds all of what he's doing. In a way that I don't think you can really tease out the separate little things. Now, I know perfectly well that there are some listeners who are thinking, but what about the lambas? She's missing the lambas. I have to mention the lambas. Because there is a very much a Eucharistic image in the lambas bread. And in a letter, he points out that there's an analogy, that, you know, the lambas has this capacity that if you basically rely on it, it allows you to, you know, to go further and to endure more than you would otherwise. And that's, you know, well, relying on God's grace, really. And he even points out that there's nothing about the lembas that if you did a microscopic analysis, it wouldn't be any different from any other bread. That's not the kind of thing it is. Same way with the consecrated host. So you put it under a microscope and it's just going to be, you know, it's going to look like bread. That's the essence of the bread. So he does make an analogy after the fact with the lembas and the Eucharist. So there is a resonance there. And I think the fact that he calls it whey bread is he's aware there's a linguistic resonance, because one of the names for the Eucharist is viaticum, which means bread of a traveler. So there's an awareness of these sort of linguistic connections, these connections of imagery. But he's not doing it like it's not allegorical. You know, it's not like, oh, this is a symbol of the Eucharist. This is such an important thing in his life. And here we have it end up being sort of naturally expressed with this lambas, which has its own story role. It doesn't, it's its own thing in the story, but it also has these Eucharistic overtones, which if you recognize them, can bring some additional depth into the story. And also, interestingly, additional sort of insight into, well, what does the Eucharist mean? It kind of works both ways now, which is pretty neat.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. Thank you for your support.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Talking about sort of if you know, you see some of these elements, is it possible to discern some of Tolkien's Marian devotion in The Lord of the Rings or in any of his other works of literature, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the hobbits embodying humility. And because Mary is preeminently the figure of humility, the hobbits are actually Marian figures. And that's unexpected. Mm-hmm. But, you know, part of Catholic spirituality is that Mary is a role model for every Christian. She's considered to be the perfect disciple. And she says, you know, in the wedding at Cana, you know, to the servant, do whatever Jesus tells you. Well, that's advice for all of us, right? Just do whatever he tells you. So Mary is the perfect disciple. And so Mary is a role model for every Christian, whether male or female. And so that sense of Mary as a model means that you can have male characters who have Marian qualities just as well as female characters. So the hobbits are very much Marian in their humility and yet their role in defeating evil. But we also see, you know, other characters who have more obviously Marian qualities, like Galadriel is often recognized as being kind of a Marian figure in, you know, her blessing and care of the fellowship. not identical, but, you know, resonances. But interestingly, Eowyn is also a figure who has some Marian resonances, because one of the sort of unexpected things about discovering that the Catholic views on Mary is that Mary is also seen as a kind of a warrior figure, you know, because she helps him defeat Satan. You know, it's her son who overcomes Satan. And so there's often, Mary is often depicted in art as actually stepping on a snake, you know, depicting the way that she's you know, involved in crushing the head of Satan. And so when you have Eowyn, who literally decapitates, you know, the Witch King's steed, that's actually a Marian figure. It's Mary in the warrior mode, as opposed to, you know, Mary in the more contemplative mode. And so, again, this is very much the way that Tolkien works. You don't have a single Christ figure. You have Christ sort of imaged in Frodo and Sam and Gandalf and Aragorn. You don't have a single Mary figure, but you have aspects of her in Galadriel, in Eowyn, in The Hobbits. It's kind of how it works.
Now, this might be a whole podcast in and of itself, but do you think it's possible to discern a particular theology or theologies in The Lord of the Rings? I mean, is Tolkien trying to say anything specifically about God? Or, as you say, is it just kind of on the fundamental level and he's not explicitly trying to put forward a particular message?
I would be very, very cautious about that. I don't think that he is. I mean, I think that certain things that he believed obviously are expressed. He's not going to deliberately express anything in the story that goes against what he believes to be true theologically. But he's not setting out to write a story that is theological. And I think that's really important to underscore. I don't think that we can or should try to read back from The Lord of the Rings into Tolkien's theology as if it was sort of a theology textbook, because that's doing violence to what it is. And it's doing violence to the way that it was created, because, you know, why did Tolkien write The Lord of the Rings? Well, he wrote it because The Hobbit was a success and his publisher asked for a sequel. I mean, that's the genesis of The Lord of the Rings. It's so prosaic for a work of epic genius, but that's how things start. And he started out as a sequel to The Hobbit, and it grew and it grew and it became more complex. That's why it took a decade to write. And it becomes this beautifully crafted work in which he is expressing all of these themes, some of which are theological. I mean, for instance, he talks about the way that one of the themes of The Lord of the Rings is about the conflict for who has ultimate power. You know, does God have divine power, or is he trying to wrestle divine power from God in the form of, you know, the ring? I'm loosely paraphrasing from one of his letters. So there are themes in there, death, the desire for deathlessness, good and evil. These are all themes that are outworking in The Lord of the Rings, but they come unconsciously in his writing, and then he shapes them deliberately to say what he wants to say. He is aware that he wants to convey, in one letter, he says he wants to convey truths, you know, about good morals. He wants to do that. But that's not what he starts from. That's what he's doing as he's crafting and polishing. So he's definitely not setting out to, you know, to instruct or to do a theological tone. And I think that if we kind of keep that in mind, we're going to have a more fruitful engagement with it, because if you do it the other way around, I think it can lead to some very painful contortions of the book.
And that's really, really helpful, Holly. I mean, just as we sort of come to a close, do you think there are any characters in The Lord of the Rings that Tolkien particularly identifies with?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because it's so hard not to project oneself onto it, and say, what do I particularly identify with? I mean, he did say in a letter, kind of, you know, sort of half jokingly, I am a hobbit in everything but size. So I think he identifies himself with the hobbits more than the other characters. And I think that would be where I would put him. And I do sometimes feel that, you know, Sam is modeled in some part after his Batman in the First World War, his servant in the war. And so it's not exactly Tolkien, but I think there's a lot of that down-to-earth quality. I mean, Tolkien was also interested in gardening. He loved plants. I think there's a lot of Tolkien in Sam, but I think certainly in The Hobbits in general, I think that's where you're going to find the most of John Ronald Reuel.
Well, and just as we end, you mentioned the sort of gardening, and obviously in the long, arduous process of writing The Lord of the Rings, which took, you know, nearly a decade, Tolkien also wrote the wonderful short story Leif by Niggle. How does that relate to his magnum opus?
It's a fascinating story, and it's a beautiful story. Highly recommend it to listeners. And it's very uncharacteristic, because he just woke up one day with a story in his mind, and he sat down and he wrote it pretty much as it is and was done. There is nothing else that I know of that Tolkien wrote that was like that. It's so uncharacteristic. And really one of the, it's deeply connected to The Lord of the Rings, because he wrote it right around the time when he was really having doubts as to whether The Lord of the Rings would ever be published. And, you know, we have this whole theme in Leif by Niggle of the painter Niggle who's trying to paint this tree, and he never has time to do anything, and it's never complete. And then he dies, and the story is about, you know, what happens to him after his death. And so it's very much about, as even Tolkien says, about my personal tree, The Lord of the Rings, that he's trying to finish. Will he ever finish it, or will it just, you know, will it still be unpublished when he dies? And so there's a lot of that personal wrestling with creativity and art and the relationship between the creator and the created work. So in some ways, it's kind of a riff on the creative process of The Lord of the Rings. It's also a theological tale. He says it's about purgatory. And it's very personal. It's really about almost his anxieties about writing The Lord of the Rings. So it's a very fascinating story, kind of a little sapling next to the great oak of The Lord of the Rings, but very connected.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.